Lisa, I'm very happy you're here. I was quite curious about when you started your filmmaking career, and you were just telling me you started with Your Debt to Me in 2013.
Yes, I started in 2013 was the first film that I produced. And it's called You're Dead to Me. And before that, actually, we had started Mr. Soul, but that was an arduous effort of filmmaking, but also fundraising and directing, producing, and a lot of development. So while I was starting Mr. Soul back in 2009, I joined this new project in 2013, and that was You're Dead to Me. And that was just a beautiful story. It's a short film about a Chicana mother coming to terms with the loss of her transgender child. We were kind of ahead of our time in terms of the, storytelling of this kind of story in 2013. I was really well received. It was kind of a haunting story, but also a love story about acceptance and forgiveness. And it takes place on Dia de los Muertos, which is the Day of the Dead. And it appeared at many, screened at many different film festivals and won many different awards, including the Imagen Award, which is like the Image Awards, the Latin Image Awards of 2013.
Live and in color from New York City, Soul.
I'm Ellis Hastings, producer of Soul, and we are happy to have you with us this evening.
There were so few positive African American images on television.
We needed to reimagine ourselves on this American landscape. Do
you know who? Yo, this is every day.
You can lie to me. Treat me the same way you would treat him.
I can't treat
you. You must. You grin at him all day long. Fake it with me.
That program was so beyond its time that it was in time.
Soul was giving TV exposure to activist revolutionaries. The FBI was very, very disturbed by that.
How did we get rid of
it? This is a piece of history. Let's fight for it.
There exists no TV program that deals with my culture so completely, so freely, and so beautifully. Black seeds keep on growing.
So now it sounds to me like you've won all the awards you could win with Mr. Soul. I'm not sure you can go any higher, right? You guys just ha signed a contract with HBO Max, is that correct?
Yes,
So
we're so excited to be on HBO Max. It's been a long and arduous journey. It took 10 years to make the film. And what we really wanted most for the film was exposure and visibility. And, we released the film several times. The first time was in 2018 at film festivals. And we played it over, gosh, 50, over 50 film festivals. We had something like 32 nominations and 21 awards or so. And it was really exciting, but we didn't actually sell the film at that time as we thought we would. So, of course, determined to have the widest visibility, we decided to release it virtually in 2020 after the pandemic happened. And we didn't know what the status was with, theatrical distribution, since during the pandemic, so many theaters were closing and it was a little bit uncertain. So we went ahead and we released, we created sort of a virtual release, which was unheard of at the time. And we released it in what turned out to be between 60 and 90 cinemas across the country. And that was really exciting because it's such a positive film and uplifting. And we needed it during that time of unrest in the country, after the George Floyd murder and the uprising and revolution that happened. We wanted to do something to contribute at that time. And since Mr. Soul is such an uplifting, powerful, engaging, and positive film with positive Black images, kind of a love letter to Black culture, we thought, what better way to contribute to the Black Lives Matter movement and give back at a time that was, really fraught in this country. And so we were able to release the film then. And that was a way of giving back to the cinemas. We had a partnership with cinemas that we did sort of a cost share where we would, a revenue share rather, where we would release the film in these theaters that had virtual platforms. And half the fee would go to the theaters to help them keep their lights on while the doors were closed during the pandemic. And also people could choose their favorite theater, you know, down the street or whatever, to screen the film and support that film. And then the other half went to us. And so it was a way of helping to nurture the film community and at the same time release the film. And so we could qualify for the Oscars and do what we had to do for our awards campaign. It was really wonderful. And then we released the film on PBS during Black History Month in 2021. And then finally, in August of 2021, the film was released on HBO Max. So now you can see it on HBO Max nationwide, not in Europe. We're still working on that, but nationwide in the United States for the next 3 years.
Congratulations.
Yes, it's been quite a journey.
What a success. What a success. And it sounds to me like you just never gave up.
I never gave up because we knew that it was an important film. We knew it was a story, you know, not just Black history, but Black history is American history. And that it was important. It was kind of a hidden figure story. This idea of, you know, the first Black Tonight Show, kind of, I would call it the best show you've never heard of. And so many people fell in love with this, but it was also a part of our history that we don't know. And yet we wanted to connect it and bridge the gap of Black excellence in this country and to see where, you know, how Ellis Hazlip as a PBS programming and pioneer, how he really laid the groundwork and paved the way for so many Black talk shows and, you know, entertainment shows. Because without Soul, which was the show, there wouldn't have been a Soul Train. And without Soul Train, there wouldn't have been Arsenio and all of these, and so on and so on and so on. So we just knew that it would be just the right type of, you know, engaging and illuminating history. And everybody has responded so well to it. It's really a love letter to Black culture, as I said. But I think it's also important to illuminate these figures in our culture who are lesser known. And we can recognize, you know, that Black excellence is not just a hashtag, that it always has existed. And this, you know, continuum of the culture is finally being embraced, you know, now that the United States is kind of at a, almost like a inflection point after what happened last summer.
And so Soul, the show aired on PBS from 1968 to 1973.
Yes, that's right. So imagine this is 1968, just 5 months after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And in America, it was fraught with, you know, what they called race riots, but we like to call them uprisings and the beginning of a revolution, the demanding for equality and equal rights. And that also translated to television because there wasn't any representation at the time. And they realized, you know, after the Public Broadcasting Act, they also realized that there was no representation on television. And so there was no real way of mirroring the actual culture in America. And it was, we needed representation just like we need it now. And so it was a really bold move to create this show. Soul was not only a vehicle for African-American artistry, but it was a platform for political expression and the fight for social justice. And that was not the model we knew for, you know, The Tonight Show or Ed Sullivan or any of the other shows that were on that we were used to. And so the palette of television, not just public television, but regular television, was monochromatic. There were no Black people or people of color on television. So this idea that there could be a space for politicians and Black culture, music, dance, art, poetry, all the expressions of the African-American community on television, that was really radical. It was very, you know, revolutionary. They say the revolution wouldn't be televised, but it actually was.
You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised.
And it's important to, you know, because the show was on public television and the nation hadn't started archiving yet, this idea of archiving live shows or live television, many of those episodes were lost. And the idea of soul was kind of like a mythical, magical unicorn, a black unicorn, you know. So it was important for me, not only because of the story, but because Ellis Hazelip is my uncle. So it was very much part of my, you know, personal family legacy that I wanted to see documented as well. And I think that's also why I never gave up. You know, it's an unusual film to be completely funded by grants. We didn't have any, you know, financiers in the corner, no sugar daddies anywhere, nobody giving us money. And we, when we started the film, it was just an idea. So we didn't actually have a broadcast contract or a series that would we would be, you know, on. So there was no guarantee that the film would be seen. So we had to try really, really hard. And I think that's why it took so long, and for me as a first-time filmmaker, to receive the funding that we needed. But consequently, over many years subsequently, I was able to write all the grants, and we received funding from the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Ford Foundation, and many, you know, government grants that gave the film visibility, and also from the Library of Congress. And that was really important too. Ken Burns, we were part of the first Ken Burns Prize for Film. And so that was presented by the Library of Congress. And so situating soul within that cultural history in the canon of, you know, important, significant television shows that changed the landscape of television, that was important too. So these were the goals of the film. They were much bigger than just say, you know, a film to watch. We knew that we were reframing the narrative of our broadcast history and our cultural history. And so that's why we never gave up.
And so did you have like, how did that work for you? Did you have a schedule or, you know, you had a vision, of course, you wanted this film to be released and to be seen. And so did you have like a routine? Would you wake up in the morning and then maybe write down what this vision was, or what were some of the things you would start the day with, and how would you organize your schedule throughout the day during these years where you had to keep applying? And I'm sure that there were many moments where you felt perhaps discouraged.
Oh yeah.
What gave you the strength to, aside from the fact that Ellis was your uncle, what other like techniques did you use to just continue regardless?
Yes, that's very important. And because the key was always fundraising, because there was no one to just write a check and there was no producer coming, there was no financial producer. You know, I was the director, producer, and writer, and I didn't have $1 million. So the goal was always financial, but also in order to have funding from the government, from the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, we began the route of, you know, building relationships with these funding entities, you know, having advisors within there, and we kept applying. So you start from the bottom with development grants, and you start writing these grants and creating relationships with your, you know, senior funding advisors there at the granting organizations, and you let them know that you're very serious. And in the meantime, the problem with grants and why it took so long is because the grants exist on a cycle. You know, there's a spring cycle and a fall cycle. So if you spend a whole year writing a grant in the fall and in the spring you learn that you didn't receive it, that means you've lost a whole year and nothing has happened and no money has come in. So you just keep working and working and working. And in the meantime, I did a lot of fellowships, with filmmaking fellowships that would support me and support my art. And that would also, you know, you have to kind of find your tribe and your village and keep working and keep building. So every time you get a little money from a grant, you build another scene or you build a work in progress, and then you use that work in progress to submit for more grants and more grants and more grants. And then when you get that money in, you shoot a little more and you add more content. So every day was really about how can we fund this film? What are the grant cycles coming up? And also recognizing that many of the people in the film are sort of the, you know, great African-American icons of the 20th century. We were worried about losing them. And so trying to kind of create relationships with the people, the artists of the film, and knowing that we had to interview them soon. Mm-hmm. And so we were always working very hard to shoot as much as we can whenever we had the funding.
Yeah, we just lost Greg Tate, for instance.
I know. Yeah, uh-huh. Now, Greg Tate is so special to us. Greg Tate actually was the one who said to me way back in 2008, you know, your uncle was a genius. And I happened to have a bootleg copy of the Al Green tape. And at that time, that was like the holy grail, because, you know, you couldn't have access to this footage. It wasn't online anywhere. There was no bootleg copies of it. And so he actually had a VHS tape of the Al Green episode. And I said, where did you get that? And Greg, who's been a friend of mine since 1986, Greg actually said, well, there's this guy who comes to the East Village and he lays out his tapes every Wednesday. And I snagged it. It was so like ninja, you know. And so Greg Tate was always, you know, first and foremost, he understood the assignment. He knew that Ellis Hazup was a curator of the culture and that what he had done was groundbreaking. And so he was always supporting us from the beginning. And he was one of our first five interviews. And let's see, we shot our first interview in 2009 in November, and then we got a little money in 2010. And that's when we shot the interview with Greg Tate. So he's always been always in our corner. And it just was heartbreaking to lose him recently. You know, he's just one of the most extraordinary writers, thinkers, and you know, yeah, it really breaks my heart. We didn't have him for long enough, I really feel. I knew him when he was writing at the Village Voice back in the 80s. And that was kind of the vanguard of, you know, edgy, important cultural happenings in New York City as part of that moment in time. And so he was always, it was really key for him to, in the film, you'll see, he's the one that does the commenting on the Al Green episode, because that was a tribute to him, you know, first giving me the tape back in the early 2000s.
Oh no, I love Greg Tate, and you know, great musician as well.
Oh, incredible. Yes. Yeah, very yes, rich. Burnt Sugar, you know, all the way. Yeah, it's just someone that we all came up with. He was like the grand poobah of culture, and mm-hmm. I just can't imagine him being gone. When you just said his name, it just, you know, I could feel it in my heart that I really haven't accepted the fact that he's gone. But thank God he was here. Mm-hmm. And his work will be appreciated, you know, for years to come.
Yeah. Some of the other key figures for this film and this project are Michael Tyner as well, Kool and the Gang, Questlove. Can you tell me a little bit about also these incredible artists?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the artists who appeared on Soul were extraordinary. It's kind of an embarrassment of riches. There were 130 episodes, and each was an hour long. So you can imagine that he had everyone from Al Green, Earth, Wind and Fire, The Dells, Nikki Giovanni interviewing James Baldwin, which, by the way, is a clip that's gone viral on Instagram and Twitter.
Just because white people say they're white, we're not obliged to believe it. You know, just because the Pope says he's a Christian, we're not obliged to believe it.
It would be crazy, you know, if we did.
We had to make our own definitions and begin to rule the world that way. Because kids, white and black, cannot use what they have been given.
No. And they're rejecting it.
They're rejecting it. Nobody wants to become the president of Pan Am, or the governor of California, or Spiro Agnew. The kids want to live.
What I most loved about the James Baldwin and Giovanni episode is you could see James Baldwin's fire, which of course you get on the pages of anything he writes. But the intonation, all the ways in which he conveys and articulates his words with his whole body. You get that, but you also get this kind of mentorship.
But also really unusual artists that you hadn't heard of or that were making their debut, like Arsenio Hall doing magic tricks for the first time at the age of 16, you know, on television, or Ashford and Simpson for the first time, Earth, Wind and Fire for the first time. It was just an extraordinary grouping of now we know as household names, Stevie Wonder, of course, Alvin Ailey's troupe, and it was really remarkable, McCoy Tyner, the jazz artist. But what was interesting about it is that he understood the plurality of Black culture and the differences. And so he never thought that there was any need to have the same kind of show or the same types of artists at the same time. He would juxtapose the sacred and the profane, you know, these radical poets like The Last Poets, but then he'd pair them with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. So he never discriminated within the culture, whether it was high or low, whether it was Muhammad Ali or, you know, the Dells. And he would have one of my favorite episodes is, it was Harry Belafonte, and he was on there with the great Sidney Poitier, who just left us. And they're talking about their film, which had just come out, Buck and the Preacher, and imagining taking us along the journey of Black artists and filmmakers, knowing that there would be Black directors in the future who would have greater opportunities than them. You know, it's just really, really remarkable to see that kind of forward thinking, even at a time of great oppression in the late 60s. And one of my favorite interviews for the film is actually Questlove, because he too really appreciates all this sort of unearthing important cultural moments in our history, which you now see, of course, with his film Summer of Soul. And many have connected Mr. Soul with Summer of Soul because it has a similar energy around resurrecting these lost cultural moments that are touchstones in our history, collective history. And what I learned when I interviewed Questlove, we were right there at the Tonight Show, squeezed into this tiny little green room, and we could hear him and Jimmy Fallon finishing up the taping. And then he ran in. It was such a small room. There was only room for him, myself, and the DP. You know, the sound person had to set up and go outside. And Questlove, revealed that he had every Soul tape that existed, that he was so obsessed with the series, and that he had actually modeled the Roots' set list after different songs that they'd seen performed on Soul. And I thought that was really remarkable because, he's such a cultural guru and brilliant curator of the culture himself, that here's someone who's so modern and so musically, musical genius. It really surprised me to know that he'd be so obsessed with a series like Soul. But it was really important to interview him, as a contemporary, to talk about how growing up as a child in a really woke household, that was his cultural assignment, to watch that show as a kid, and that his parents, encouraged him to watch it. His parents were both really involved in the movement. And, it's just exciting to know that as a child, somebody that show Soul had such an impression on Questlove as a child that it really led to who he is today. So it's really remarkable because there's so many different episodes of Soul that are devoted to different styles of music, different conversations, different crises that were going on in the Black community. And you don't usually see this kind of quilt of unapologetically Black culture that hasn't been edited, that's just spoken from the heart. You don't usually see that on television. We certainly haven't seen it since. So it really is kind of breathtaking when you see this, when you see the early Soul shows that showed jazz musicians. Jazz was not something that you saw. It was something that you heard if you were lucky enough to go to the Blue Note, or the different types of R&B musicians that would be on the Chitlin circuit or up at the Apollo, or on the radio, but you didn't get to see them. So this idea of visibility as, validation was really, really key to say, we do exist. We are part of the cultural fabric of America, and there is something happening. We are changing. Ellis Hazel believed in the liberation of our people, and that our culture would lead to that. if we could see it, if it could be brought into Americans' homes, mm-hmm. and especially white and non-Black Americans who wouldn't invite Black people into their homes, it was safe to bring them in through the television. And so this idea of television became, you know, a mass communicator. And it also created a Black, national Black audience. So yeah, the show was really, really groundbreaking. And I'm really happy that not only is the film entertaining, but it's educational. And we were also able to get an educational distributor for the film, which will situate the film in college campuses and universities and libraries and can be used as part of the curriculum.
So yes, I think I understand what you're saying. Do you feel that sometimes people abroad in other countries still have a hard time understanding that someone like Miles Davis or John Coltrane are actually American icons?
Yeah.
Do you think that a lot of American icons, just because they're African Americans, are still not totally seen as American, whether here in the United States or in other countries?
I think that because we have this legacy of enslavement in our country, and it really scarred our country and our understanding of humanity, that's part of the larger discussion we're having in the country right now, especially with critical race theory and the 1619 Project. But I think that the benefit of other countries not having that has created a different kind of appreciation for Black art and Black culture. And as Questlove told me, he had to go to many other cultures and other countries like Japan, China, and the UK, where people appreciated Black culture and didn't discriminate against the people who made it, in order to find these tapes from Seoul, from the collectors, you know? And so this idea that because we have been so burdened by the remnants of slavery and discrimination in this country, Black art and culture hasn't risen to, the type of recognition that does occur in other countries. And so I really feel that it makes sense that the UK and other places would love soul music much more and more sooner than America did. And it makes sense that they embraced James Baldwin and they embraced Josephine Baker, you know, in France, and especially both of them in France, when both of those artists had to leave America to be accepted, you know. So there's a pattern there. And I thankfully, there is happening right now a shift, and we are on the eve of a racial reckoning in this country. And I think that now artists like James Baldwin are having a moment and finally being recognized for their contributions. And so that's why the timing of Mr. Soul, even after it took 10 years, the timing of it arriving right now was pivotal, really important and significant.
So Melissa, what would you recommend to younger women filmmakers who have a passion for this art form and have to deal with all the challenges that being an artist represents, and also being a woman as well? What would be some advice for younger women filmmakers here or in other countries?
Absolutely. I think it's really important for young women filmmakers, both in America and in other countries, to recognize their value and to hold on to their vision. Oftentimes, those are the two things that are, you know, I don't want to say overcompensated, but what's a good word? Compromised. What happens is, because of issues around machismo and the lack of enough women in the industry, especially here in the United States, is women don't get to lead as much. And so we're finally starting to change that, especially in the documentary community. There has been more opportunity for women to helm their own projects and not have to, you know, let a man take charge or have a director take charge of their project. So the important thing is to recognize that even though you're a woman first and a filmmaker second, you're always an artist. And so you shouldn't worry about being a woman and having to compromise your vision. because you really are an artist, and artists, your artistry comes first. And that was one of the most important things someone told me as I was actually co-working with another director who is a man. They said, don't let go of your directing title, because titles are important as well. And the fact that you are a woman helming this project is going to have so much, will resonate so much more down the line. And I really didn't think that much about it until the film came out. And then so many women and young women came toward me and they said, you are such an inspiration to us because you were able to pull this off, first of all. And how hard is it to be a woman and have a film that is shortlisted for the Oscars or that's winning awards and that's being, you know, considered in the same categories as films that are helmed by men and films that are, you know, produced by studios. Because that was the funny thing, is when Mr. Soul was in competition for all the awards, we hadn't yet had a deal. We had not yet had a deal with HBO Max. So it just appeared like we were an independent film with my production company. And so we would be in these categories with films that were being put out by HBO, you know, Amazon Prime, Netflix, you know, all the big streamers and Paramount and Peacock and CNN Films and all the major distributors of films, Magnolia. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, how are we going to hold our own? It's going to be based on the merit of the film. And so luckily, you know, we did receive like 5 nominations for the Critics' Choice Award. And we tied with another film that received 5 nominations, but they had a distributor and we didn't. So what it says, what that speaks to is perseverance and vision, and recognizing that if you are, as a woman, you do have a unique vision and a unique voice in storytelling. And so that's what you have to hold on to, the belief that your story is unique and it deserves to be told. In my work as a producer, I'm really interested in elevating the voices of women and finding stories about women as well. And then, you know, when I have my crew, I try to hire as many women as possible. All of that is intentional. You know, it's about not just getting through the door, but reaching back and bringing women with you, bringing people of color with you. That's really what it's all about. Someone like Ava DuVernay is doing the same thing. You know, she's amazing, and she has... even with her series, Queen Sugar, she has only women DPs on her team. Remarkable for all of the seasons. And so everyone has said, wow, what she's doing is so innovative and so unique that she only hires women. And and I want to say, it's not actually unique. It should be normal. It's unique because nobody else is doing it. But what it is doing is raising awareness that women artists are equally important and must, you know, really have the same opportunities as male artists. And we don't often. So, you know, just to be able to stand in your truth and tell your story as a young woman is really important. The other thing I would say as a great, two women, because you can become overwhelmed in the setting of a film, making a film, or on a crew. And if you do have a lot of men on the team, especially, I always say, you know your strengths and staff your weaknesses. So that means know what you're really good at and then hire the other people to do the rest. And it's okay. It's okay. You know, we don't have to be all powerful and do everything. It's okay to delegate. You just have to know what you're good at, know your strengths and staff your weaknesses. That was a really important lesson for me to learn. I think anybody to learn, but especially women who feel we have to take on the weight of the world.
Mm-hmm. And so now your next project you were sharing with me would be about this painter whose painting is right behind you, right?
Yes, that's one of my projects. This is an amazing painting that's actually a photograph by a woman who's an amazing multi-hyphenate artist. Her name is Fabiola Jean-Louis. And I fell in love with her work. Again, she's pushing the narrative forward and talking about this idea of rewriting history, in this case, art history, where she's putting Black women back into the narrative of representation and the lack thereof in sort of Renaissance art. If you really think about it, and I was an art history major in college, always looking for Black people in art, and you know, you could never find them. One shadowy young Black boy in a Rembrandt off in the corner somewhere, or one bust that's very famous. But we existed at that time. And so what Fabiola Jean-Louis has done is create this beautiful series called Rewriting History, in which she takes Black women and she puts them in the narrative in a setting. She also makes their costumes out of paper. And so that dress is made out of paper. And then she takes a photograph and prints it in a painterly fashion. And she just recently has an exhibit in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They have acquired her art for the first time. So I am doing a documentary about her and hoping that it will be a part of the OpDocs series on the New York Times. I'm also working on a documentary series for Netflix about women in hip hop. So again, elevating the story of women. And that's a 4-part series that's really about the history, well, the incomplete history, since we're not done, of Black women in America, Black womanhood in America, through the lens of women in hip hop, their lives and their music. So I've been working on that as a co-executive producer. And then I have a couple of other projects that are just getting started. One I can't share too much about, but it's with Westbrook Media for Apple TV. It's a behind the scenes documentary. And the other is a feature documentary about Renee Elise Goldsberry, who starred as Angelica in the wonderful story Hamilton on Broadway. So there are a lot of things cooking. And as you can see, I'm always interested in the woman's story and elevating that.
And Melissa, thank you so much for sharing all this. I have a technical question for you.
Yeah.
Do you write the scripts of your film and do you edit as well, or you don't?
Yes, I do write the scripts for my film. And much of the writing starts out as an outline, and then it becomes a script, and then it becomes a shooting script. And sometimes you have to write the script that you want. In other words, you're writing the story you want to hear. But of course, when you're shooting a documentary, you never know what they're going to say. And you can't really predict the story that will come. And it usually leads to other stories and sort of what I call happy accidents. So you do end up writing the film, and most of the writing actually occurs in the edit. And even though I'm proficient in editing, I let somebody else do that. Again, you know, staff the weaknesses. but I do sit in the edit and, you know, make sure that the vision of the film that I've written can be visually expressed in the story. So often I do write, and I'm writing, I've written the script for the Netflix doc series as well, but that's continually evolving. And I'm writing the script for several other docs as well. And it's important, because when you have a vision for the film, it's important to maintain that vision throughout. But of course, it's not a one-man sport or one-woman show. You know, it takes a village to make a film, and especially a documentary. And it's really about collaboration and honoring the talents of everyone that comes together. Especially with Mr. Soul, we had a wonderful team that continued to expand on every iteration of the film as it was released on different platforms. And so, you know, really honor the team and every hand that touches the project, because you really can't do it alone.
And also, Melissa, do you think that growing up in the Caribbean island of St. Thomas informed part of your creative spirit or perhaps your profession? Just wondering.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, growing up in St. Thomas was a real idyllic childhood for me. And I think one thing that it did sort of subconsciously was it gave me a great sense of freedom and, you know, confidence, because I was actually living on an island that had a majority of people of color, you know, Black people running things, Black people in the government, Black people everywhere, as part of the culture and the music and the parties and the language, the learning. It was all you know, the Caribbean history. And I really think that that situated me with a self, with a understanding of myself and a confidence that perhaps I wouldn't have had, you know, growing up in New York City. I was born in Boston, lived in New York City for a little bit, and then we moved to St. Thomas. And because it was this lyrical culture with a beautiful soundtrack and a very special environment, it really sort of soothed my heart and gave me a great sense of well-being. And I think that synergy comes out in my films as well. And really understanding the culture from and my place within it. I definitely think it impacted me in some way.
Thank you. Is there something, Melissa, you'd like to share with us that I didn't touch on?
Gosh, it's been such a great interview.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very happy.
I'm just really grateful, really, for you and also that you pursued us for so long. I know we were trying to get this story out, and I think it's really important that women support women, and I'm very, very excited about that and that you pursued us over time, because, you know, we have to remember, as I said earlier, that this is not a one-woman show, that we really can't exist in a vacuum. And helping other people elevate your story and tell your story and document your story is very important. So I just want to give a shout out to you.
Yes, thanks to Brian, basically. Also.
Yes, the whole team. So that's what I'm up to, all the work that I'm doing, and really very excited to be in this position because storytelling is very important. You know, it's the way we push the culture forward, and also making sure not to reframe our narrative, but to situate our truth really honestly. And to be, you know, we need voices like Ellis Hazlip now more than ever. The issues we're facing in this country about diversity, inclusion, equity, that is long overdue, right? And so it's great to say, oh, well, now's a good time, but we've been doing this for a long time. And so as we create these stories that situate us in the history of the country and our contributions to it, we are reframing the narrative and sort of restoring the truth of our contributions to this country historically, you know, as Black people. And so I'm glad to be a part of that movement and to do it in an entertaining cultural way that is positive, and to give people an access to humanity and positive Black images. I think all of that helps to, you know, turn the tide a little bit.
Yes, and I think that you're doing this with a lot of grace. And your uncle was doing this with a lot of humility, which is remarkable. Yes. Because he could have become arrogant since he did such an amazing job. But I find that both he and you are humble and graceful.
Oh, you're very kind. Mm-hmm. You know, he was very humble. And I think Ellis understood that it wasn't about him. And he was kind of an Afrofuturist in seeing a better opportunities in the future for artists that weren't happening in the 60s. And he knew that it was important to push the culture forward and that at some point that would be recognized. But it didn't discourage him from doing the work he needed to do. But he was always in the background a little bit, you know, pushing the story forward. I feel very much the same. You know, it's not about me, it's about the efforts, and it's about illuminating the work of others, such as Fabiola, such as Ellis Hazlip. You know, if I can help open people's eyes to those things, then, you know, perhaps I've done my job, you know.
You're a channel.
Yes, very much a vessel, mm-hmm. Very much. I do feel that. And it isn't about ego for me, and it isn't about Hollywood and fame, you know. It's really about reframing the narrative and pushing the culture forward.
Mm-hmm. So exciting, Melissa. I'm so happy we had this conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much.
No, and I'm so happy, and I hope everybody rushes out now to take a look at this amazing documentary, Mr. Soul. And I can't wait for your next documentary as well. Do you have a title for it, or?
Well, right now it's called the one about Fabiola is called Rewriting History right now, sort of matching her. That's the working title. Mm-hmm. And the series for hip hop is it's a working title, Women in Hip Hop. But it's also called Who You Calling a Bitch, which is a hip hop lyric from Queen Latifah. But I don't know that they've cleared that yet. Since it's her lyric, I think they'd have to do a little negotiating to get that as a title. We'll see.
Okay, wonderful, Melissa. I wish you a wonderful afternoon. And it's just so, so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be with you. I really appreciate your time, and this has been great.
Absolutely.